Welcome to Wall Street Unspun with your host, Peter Schiff.
But it's a giant bubble in search of a pin, and it's going
to
find one.
Are you confused with the ups and downs of the economy and what it means to you?
Don't believe the propaganda, and that's what it is. When you're listening to an analyst on a lot of these popular financial shows, you're not getting investment advice. You're getting propaganda.
Get ready to untangle the web of misinformation provided by the mainstream media.
These firms are trying to sell you stocks. Their real clients, their banking clients, are trying to get rid of stocks.
And now, here's your host of Wall Street Unspun, the president of Euro Pacific Capital and a licensed broker with a passion for truth. It's Wall Street Unspun with Peter Schiff.
Hello, everybody. Welcome again to another live episode of Wall Street Unspun, the midweek market update. I am Peter Schiff, host of the show, president of Euro Pacific Capital, and author of Crash Proof: How to Profit from the Coming Economic Collapse, or the now ongoing economic collapse. You can listen to the radio show every Wednesday evening live at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, 5 p.m. Pacific Time, on my website, www.europac.net, EUROPAC.net, and on shortwave radio, 5.07 megahertz. Now, this is the first time in a while I am doing this show again from California, back at the Pacific time slot, 5 p.m. Pacific time. You know, when I first started doing the show for the first couple of years, I did the show from Southern California, and I was always used to doing the show before I left for the day. And, of course, once I moved out to the East Coast, I began doing the show in the evenings at 8 p.m., so it's nice to be doing the show again at 5 o'clock. It was always much more convenient. When I first planned the show, 5 o'clock Wednesday was a more convenient time for me to do the show than 8 p.m. Wednesday once I relocated to the East Coast. But I came back to the West Coast, and I did a seminar yesterday. Many of the people listening may be, you know, might have attended the seminar. We did a seminar yesterday at the Fairmont Hotel. Yesterday on Monday evening at the Fairmont Hotel, we had over 600 people in attendance. Huge, huge turnout. You know, I remember I did a similar, seminar years ago before I moved to the East Coast. So it might have been in 2003 or 2004. I can't really remember the exact date that I did it. But we didn't even have 20 people that came to that one. And so a lot has obviously changed. Certainly, the firm has grown, but also I think it has to do with the message resonating a lot more, where people really want to do something. People really appreciate the severity of the economic crisis that is upon us. And people are getting sick and tired of the advice that they get from mainstream Wall Street firms who have basically led everybody down the primrose path to financial ruin, and they continue to champion the cause that everything is great, everything is fine, the economy is sound, and just keep on investing in U.S. stocks and bonds. So the fact that, 600 people turned out, and, we didn't even advertise the seminar. I mean, I know I mentioned it on this radio show, but this is not really advertising. I mean, it's not conventional radio. But we didn't have any newspaper advertisement. We didn't buy any ads on radio or television. And I know, I'm in the brokerage industry, and I know it's certainly common practice in the brokerage industry for brokerage firms to have investment seminars. And I know routinely they have to promise all sorts of freebies. A lot of times they give away a free dinner. They raffle off a prize. And they'll offer, a weekend stay in a hotel room to people that show up. They do all sorts of things to bribe people, and they're lucky to get 20 people to come into a room and listen to a speaker. And, we're able to get 600 people to show up in Newport Beach on the strength of an email to the database, not giving away anything. I mean, we didn't even validate parking. And so we got a lot of people coming, and hopefully they enjoyed it. And if you're calling in, you want to talk about it, feel free. I am going to be doing some more of these events. I know we have one. We're going to do one relatively soon in Manhattan, and I am going to schedule one for Washington D.C. around tax time, around April 15th. So I'm going to try to put one together rather quickly, because I agreed to meet Ron Paul and a few other people in Washington, D.C., I think, maybe April 18th, around then. So I'm going to try to coordinate my trip to Washington, D.C. with a seminar similar to the one I did in Newport Beach. So be on the lookout for an email. We haven't even set it up yet, but I'm going to try to do it. So be on the lookout for an email for my Washington, D.C. Seminar. And as I said, I'm going to be doing one relatively soon. I might have to do it after the Washington, D.C. one in Manhattan. And we're going to do some more based on, you know, how well this one was attended and how well the one that was attended down in Boca Raton, Florida. And by the way, Bruce Otterman is now down in the Southern Florida office. He's located in Palm Beach, and he's open for business down there now. The details of his branch are not up on the website yet, but he is down there, and so we'll probably be going down there as well. And, you know, while I was up here in Newport Beach, we did look at some space, and we made an offer on a property up in Los Angeles, on an office space up in Los Angeles, to really try to double the size of our presence here in Southern California to try to accommodate the growing interest in our firm, and more importantly, people's desire to actually take charge of their finances and to protect their wealth. Because it really is becoming more and more important, and the urgency is there. Also, if people are interested in seeing me in person again, the other speaking engagements, and I know I've got to update this on my website. I've been kind of lax there on the scheduled appearances, but I will be at the Vegas Money Show in May, and I will be back in Las Vegas again in July for the Freedom Fest. And if you didn't go to the Freedom Fest last year, it's great fun. There's a lot of speakers there. They're going to have a whole Peter Schiff day at the Freedom Fest. So I'm going to be doing a lot of talking. I'm going to be part of some panels and some debates with some other people there. So it should be very interesting to come and visit me at the Freedom Fest. And, of course, at the Money Show, I'll be doing my usual stuff at the Las Vegas Money Show. And this, again, will be my first appearance post-bursting of the bubble. And, you know, during the Vegas Money Shows in the past, I have constantly talked about the U.S. bubble economy, the implications for your investments when the bubble bursts. Well, I'm going to be changing the topic there because the bubble has now clearly burst, and so it puts a little bit of a different spin on what I have to say and the urgency with which people need to heed my advice. Also, in the markets, you know, what have we had? A lot of volatility. You know, gold, of course, had that huge drop at, you know, from $1,000 an ounce. Went all the way down to $900, had over $100 an ounce drop. Silver went up to $21 an ounce and went back down to $17, you know, a $4 drop. And I remember when I was buying silver for $4 an ounce. And now, of course, the price decline is $4. Also we saw a pretty big rally in the U.S. dollar. Most of that has been erased. That today the dollar closed at a new record closing low against the euro. Record closing low on the euro today. The Swiss franc was up about 2% on the day, up against 1% on the Japanese yen. The dollar is weakening once again. Silver was bounced. It was up about 80 cents yesterday, about 45 cents today. Gold was up about $25 yesterday, another 10 bucks today. So gold's back at about 940. So it's recovered about 40% of the decline from 1,000. Oil prices were up almost $5 a barrel today. Oil at 106. You know, with the big sharp drop in some of the other commodities, one of the standouts was oil. I mean, it did drop down from 110, but, you know, 100 seems like the support. You know, once upon a time, not too long ago, $100 a barrel was a solid wall of resistance for the price of oil. There was a triple top at 100, and now it seems that any dip to 100 or below is now the floor. I think the bull market is intact. I've heard a lot of people and read some commentaries, people looking for substantial pullbacks in the price of oil now. It's possible, but you know what? Oil looks very strong. It's just as likely that we've seen the pullback. The same thing with gold and silver. This could be it. You know, we had a pretty quick drop. A lot of that might have been margin-related selling, higher margin calls in the aftermath of the Bear Stearns collapse. Some of the creditors are demanding more margin money, so we might have seen some of the speculators having to pare down their positions. And again, of course, you know, what provided the fuel, the catalyst for the decline, was that Ben Bernanke's 75 basis point rate cut. And I almost was laughing when I was on Fox News and they cut rates live, and, you know, some of my fellow panelists started talking about, you know, how the Fed was hawkish on inflation because they only cut 75 basis points. I mean, this is crazy. Only 75 basis points? I mean, that's a huge rate cut. And, you know, of course, if they really cared about inflation, they wouldn't have cut rates at all. They'd have raised rates. And so there was a knee-jerk reaction. People sold gold and bought the dollar. You know, you would think there's a brand new bear market, that we have a strong dollar policy for real. You know, of course, all this is evaporating. People will figure out soon enough that, you know, it's helicopter Ben. He's still there. Nothing has changed. And in fact, not only has the Fed cut rates by 75 basis points, but they're going to cut them even more. You know, we've had a lot of weak economic data come out in the last few days again, to support the idea that the Fed is going to continue its rate cutting, again, to try to artificially, reflate the deflating bubble, which, of course, is the worst thing that they can do. It's unfortunately what they're doing. It's making the situation a whole lot worse, ultimately. And, you know, of course, you know, I mentioned the government is trying to keep real estate prices from falling. But the solution is for real estate prices to fall. The problem isn't real estate prices going down. The problem is that they went up in the first place. And, you know, what the Fed doesn't want is when you let real estate prices go back down, it exposes all the malinvestments. That's when people realize that trillions of dollars of money that was loaned out is never going to get repaid, because the collateral is not there, and the means nor the will is there for the borrowers to ever repay it. So these are enormous losses. It's not just billions or hundreds of billions that Wall Street is fessing up to. It's trillions that is going to be lost. And of course, if the Federal Reserve tries to, you know, wipe those losses away, deny that they exist, and simply print money, which is what they're doing now. The Fed is printing money. They've bought hundreds of billions of dollars worth of mortgages already. You know, and meanwhile, at the same time, the private sector is tightening up on lending standards, finally. The government is doing the opposite. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are being urged to lend, you know, more recklessly, to lend with less collateral, to let people buy homes with smaller down payments. So the government is trying to recreate the lax lending standards in the private sector, in the public sector rally, that were in large part responsible for the real estate bubble in the first place. And so what's going to happen, as long as, you know, real estate prices remain artificially high, no one in the private sector is going to want to underwrite mortgages. So more and more mortgages are going to be going into the public sector. And of course, even if they're guaranteed by Freddie and Fannie Mac, when people buy those bonds, they're not going to want to hold them. They're going to go to the Fed, and they're going to give those bonds to the Fed in exchange for treasuries. And, you know, no one seems to ask, when the Fed swaps treasuries for mortgage-backed securities, where does the Fed get the treasuries? Well, it buys them. Well, how does it buy them? Well, it prints money. It credits the account of the seller of those treasuries with Federal Reserve notes in its account at the Fed. So the Fed is basically printing money, buying treasuries, and then swapping the treasuries for mortgages. Ultimately, what's happening is our money is being backed by mortgage debt. The Fed is ultimately going to acquire probably trillions of dollars of mortgage-related securities, and it's not going to stop with mortgages. If the Fed's going to be in there as the buyer of first and last and only resort, it's going to buy all sorts of debt that nobody wants to try to keep the true value from being evident. They're going to buy credit card debt. They're going to buy auto loans. They're going to buy student loans. You know, the Fed is going to buy all manner of debt to try to keep the truth from being revealed. And, of course, we're talking about massive, massive inflation. The dollar is going to get killed. And Americans who have U.S. dollars and U.S. dollar savings and dollar assets are going to lose trillions in purchasing power. You know, the Fed can't prevent the losses from happening. It can just change the way the losses are expressed. Rather than having people lose dollars, they simply have people who have dollars lose purchasing power. But unfortunately, when the Fed does that, it transfers the losses from the people who should incur them, the speculators and the lenders and Wall Street. It transfers those losses to people who had absolutely nothing to do with the real estate bubble. Some little old lady who's been renting her apartment all along, who's been living off of a fixed income and has some money in government bonds, she's the one that's going to be suffering the losses because the Federal Reserve is basically transferring those losses to her from creditors of Bear Stearns or shareholders of Morgan Stanley now, or Lehman Brothers or Merrill Lynch or who knows how many other firms would be going under right now were they not being bailed out by the Federal Reserve. So what you people need to do is understand the dynamics here and not volunteer to be the patsy. You know, not volunteer to just have your savings debased. This is one tax you can avoid. You know, the greatest, tax loophole now is to get out of U.S. currency, get out of U.S. assets, so you do not become the recipient of these losses. You don't have the losses thrown on your shoulders. You avoid this tax by avoiding the dollar, by getting out of U.S. dollar-denominated assets entirely. And again, that's what I've been encouraging everybody to do at Euro Pacific Capital, and that's what I'm still encouraging people to do who are my clients who are listening to this broadcast is to rapidly divest yourselves of your U.S. dollars. And I've got a growing team of brokers now to help you construct portfolios denominated in euros and Swiss francs and Singapore dollars and Australian dollars and Canadian dollars and get into income-producing assets and buy into these dips in precious metals. Gold and silver continue to protect your purchasing power because no one's going to do it for you. Don't look to the government to protect you. Don't look to the Federal Reserve to protect you. You know, I got into a discussion again with a reporter today where people are trying to reassure her readers that everybody's money is safe because if you have it in a government-guaranteed account, nobody's money is safe. That's the point. That's the problem. Nothing is safe. It doesn't matter if the government promises that you're going to get your dollars. They don't promise that your dollars are going to have any value, and they're not going to have value if we continue on this path. And even if they have some value, it'll be a lot less value than the dollar has now, and so there's no reason to just sit there and take it when you have the ability to avoid it by reallocating your portfolio. Anyway, let me quickly take some of your phone calls. I've got the first one from London, England. Okay, Carlo on the line. It's late out there in London. How are you?
It is indeed. Very good. Thanks very much for taking my call, Mr. Schiff. I had one question, actually, and a comment afterwards. The first one is I've heard you chatting, obviously, over the last several months, certainly about the Chinese peg, the yuan peg to the dollar. When I mentioned this to somebody yesterday, they said, no, are you sure that that's the case? And when I looked at it, I saw that there was actually a decoupling in 2005, I believe. So the question I have you got any clarification as to when you talk about this peg, is it a formal peg? Is it?
Yeah, well, there no longer is a peg in the relationship that is fixed and does not change. That was the case for many years. But you're correct. They loosened the peg, and now they've got maybe what they call a soft peg, where the government is managing the appreciation of the yuan versus the dollar, and they're only letting it rise by a very small percentage. So it's pegged, but the peg is changing. And so instead of the yuan, being flat with the dollar on an annual basis, maybe it's being allowed to rise by 10 or 15% per year. But
okay,
if the free market were allowed to set the exchange rate in the absence of government controls, the yuan would be rising at a much more rapid pace than is currently allowed. But there are other countries too, particularly in the Middle East, that are still maintaining fixed pegs. And there is still a fixed peg with the Hong Kong dollar. The Hong Kong dollar is pretty much exactly where it was a few years ago against the U.S. dollar, and it's not being allowed to move.
Right. So when this decoupling then could actually be something that's fairly gradual, if you like, rather than there isn't a formal agreement which would change.
When I talk about decoupling, I'm mainly talking about the synchronization of global economies and global stock markets, which I think will decouple from the U.S. I think the U.S. economy will sink while the rest of the world prospers. I don't think it's going to be a case where, we get sick and we catch a cold and the world gets pneumonia. I think that's not going to be the case. But you're talking about depegging. Yes, eventually I believe that the world is going to, completely remove itself from the dollar. Right now, I just read an article in the Wall Street Journal the other day that inflation in Saudi Arabia was a 27-year high. I mean, there are people who are rioting in the streets down there. You know, the same kind of social unrest is possible in China because food prices are going through the roof. This is all a result of maintaining these relationships with the U.S. dollar. We are exporting our irresponsible monetary policy to those countries that have pegged their currency to ours. And so we're exporting our inflation all around the world, and people around the world, poor people in other countries, are suffering because of what we're doing and what their governments are doing to maintain the relationship with the dollar. It has to end. And when it does end, the rest of the world can breathe a sigh of relief. The rest of the world can solve their inflation problems. But in so doing, they are going to inflict massive problems on us. And of course, this is where the problems need to be because we're the source of it.
Yeah. Well, that's, I can certainly see the effects over here of the inflation, that's for sure. So,
I think you see more inflation. The pound hit an all-time low today against the euro. And so obviously, and I think you guys have a bit of a problem over there as well. Not as bad as the U.S., but you have one.
Absolutely. And I've been listening to what you've been saying about the States, and I've certainly been trying to turn as many people over here onto what's happening because the situation isn't as bad, people are probably even less aware over here. But
Have you read my book out there?
I have your book. In fact, it arrived about 3 days ago, so I've started it, and I've already...
Have you seen it in the bookstores over there?
No, I got it on Amazon, in fact, because I came across your clips. I'm a big supporter of Ron Paul myself. Now, unfortunately, I can't vote in the U.S. elections, but if I could, I would certainly be voting that way. But I came across clips of you in relation to Ron Paul on YouTube, and the moment I listened to what you were saying, it made absolute sense as far as I was concerned. So there is a...
Nice that Ron Paul's got supporters, on the other side of the pond.
All over the world, absolutely, absolutely.
Well, it's a common cause. I mean, liberty and, you know, it's difficult to defend it, and it's under attack from politicians all over the world, so...
Yeah. Absolutely.
Thanks for the call. Next time, if you stop in any bookstores, you know, ask them if they have a copy of Crash Proof. We've got to get some copies in the bookstores over there.
I'm fighting the calls for you, Mr. Schiff. Don't worry about that.
Thanks.
Many thanks.
Okay, let me take a quick commercial break, and we'll be back for more calls.
Euro Pacific Capital is an independent brokerage firm on a mission to inform its client base and prospective clients about economic and market events that could affect their financial security. Euro Pacific Capital seeks to provide solutions which are intended to provide safety, not risk. Solutions designed to protect our clients and their families from the U.S. government and its inflationary practices. The time to act is now, while you still have the opportunity to get your money out of the dollar. It's legal to do so, and after a consultation with one of Euro-Pacific's brokers, you will understand how this decision could ensure your financial security. We offer a full array of services ranging from retirement and trust accounts to complete financial planning, checking accounts with or without debit cards, and life insurance, even annuities. With our independent, no-nonsense investment advice that's a cut above the run-of-the-mill commentary that has passed for research for far too long on Wall Street, we suspect investors will find a home at Euro Pacific Capital.
Hi, we are back. This is Peter Schiff. You are listening live to Wall Street Unspun, the midweek market outlook. I am Peter Schiff, host of the show, author of Crash Proof, How to Profit from the Coming Economic Collapse. I am taking your calls live. 888-678-9597, 888-678-9597, coming to you live from sunny Southern California in Newport Beach. And the next call is from Len in New York. How are you, Len?
Good, thanks. Thanks for taking my call. I've been listening to you since I ran into you on CNBC about 6-8 months ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I can tell from your conversations that, you know, a lot of your understanding, even though obviously you're very present, I guess is the expression, a lot of your understanding seems to be unfolding as things are coming about. You know, like you're saying things that wouldn't necessarily have been so obvious, but they're unfolding, so you see them, and I'm very impressed. The thing, going back to the euro you were just talking about,
mm-hmm.
I guess, you know, I'm a big fan of the Canadian dollar because I think they have one of the healthiest economies, but they haven't been advancing so much recently, I guess because they're so tied to the U.S.
Yeah, that's part of the problems for Canada, and they did have a rate reduction not too long ago. But, you know, I think the chart looks good for the Canadian dollar. I mean, right now it's been trading, you know, above and below parity with the dollar. But ultimately, I think, you know, we're going to head higher. The Canadian dollar did get as high as 110 before pulling back. So that's the near-term target, I think, is for the, you know, the Canadian dollar to move to the 110 level. And ultimately, it's going to go higher than that. It's, you know, I don't know how high it's going to go. It's impossible to know for sure because I don't know how low the dollar is going to go. It's ultimately a bottomless pit. And if we don't veer from the course that we're on right now, the dollar will lose a substantial percentage of its value. I think, you know, possibly well in excess of half of its value, which would mean that ultimately, you know, you would need more than $2 to buy one Canadian dollar. And I wouldn't be surprised were that to happen.
Right. I guess my question, though, is about the euro. I didn't actually investigate this, but someone was telling me that comparable to, you know, we have roughly a $14 trillion economy, however you might measure $14 trillion, and, you know, something in the neighborhood of $9 trillion in debt. And someone was mentioning to me that if you took the economy of, you know, that encompasses the euro, and you compared the debt level that they have to ours, it would be even in higher percentage. And
I don't think so. I mean, I think,
you don't think
they,
so.
They try to claim that the government debts are a higher percentage of our GDPs. And I'm not sure if that's the case or not. I know that the European Union right now represents a larger economy than the United States, if you just take the GDP of the region, of the countries sharing the euro versus the United States. But the more important factors are if you take the European Union as a community, they have a credit. They are creditors. They have a trade surplus, and they are a creditor nation. And they have a high domestic savings rate, which means they don't have to borrow a lot of money from the outside world. The United States is in the opposite situation. We are a debtor nation. We have a huge trade deficit, and we have minimal domestic savings. So we are in much worse shape than is Europe. And even if Europe had more debt than we do, they can afford it. They have the savings. They can finance that debt. And they also have a trade surplus. I mean, we're in a very vulnerable situation in that we can't afford it. I get a lot of comparisons. People think, well, maybe we're going to be like Japan. We're going to have zero interest rates for a long time. We can't be like Japan because nobody will loan us money at zero interest rates. See, when Japan had zero interest rates, or if they still do, they didn't have to convince anybody to lend them money because the Japanese had the savings themselves. And Japanese citizens were happy to buy low-yielding Japanese government bonds, I guess because it was still better than losing money in real estate and stocks. But there's no reason to expect the Japanese or the Europeans or anyone else to buy zero-yielding U.S. government bonds or any other U.S. dollar-denominated debt with the U.S. dollar sinking in value. I mean, why would anybody around the world want to assume currency risk for no interest? Because the Japanese didn't assume currency risk because they were Japanese-based investors, and so they didn't look at it that way. But I still think that the European Union is a far, far better place to invest than the United States, and we're going to continue to put money there.
I guess the prospect of, you know, of inflation really seriously heating up came to me when I realized that, you know, basically the trillions, or at least about $1 trillion of garbage mortgage debt, which if they were ordinary mortgages would be amortizing over 30 years, by being able to borrow against them, they're basically making that money available 30 years earlier, or, you know, over that period of time earlier. And the second problem, obviously, is that, you know, they're talking about it, but of course, when you give somebody free money, you know, the Treasury is now lending against these bonds as though they had a value.
Yeah, look, the bigger problem, of course, is that now all these Wall Street investment banks have access to the Fed's discount window, and they're able to put all kinds of questionable collateral up there and get money and do knows, you know, who knows what with it. But look, the Fed has opened up the monetary spigots. You know, Helicopter Ben is living up to his nickname. And we all need to take them at their word over there and see what they're doing and act accordingly. But thanks for the call. And since you mentioned the Canadian dollar, we might as well take a call from a Canadian citizen. We've got Sam on the line from Alberta. Go ahead, Sam.
Hi, Peter. Thanks for taking my call. Actually, the last guy stole part of my question. he asked about the currency one-to-one in Canada and U.S. Do you see that continuing? I know you kind of answered that.
I see ultimately the Canadian dollar moving quite a bit higher than one-to-one. And I see a lot of other currencies that are going to break through. You know, the Swiss franc, I had even mentioned on this show that I thought the next currency that was going to break the parity was going to be the Swiss franc, and that has in fact already happened. The Swiss franc is now worth slightly more than the dollar. And from that respect, you know, parity, the Japanese yen has broken parity with the penny, whereas, you know, you now get fewer than 100 yen for your dollar. So the yen has broken parity with the penny. And I think the next major currency that will also break parity will be the Australian dollar. That's right now just a little over 90 cents. I think it got as high as 94 cents before the recent correction. But I think that the Australian dollar will move above parity as well. And by the time the Australian dollar is worth, you know, above the U.S., the Canadian dollar will have a little bit of a distance between itself and the dollar as well. And those currencies might never look back. I mean, you know, once the Canadian dollar gets above 110, you know, it might never get back down to parity again. I mean, at least not in the foreseeable future.
And two other questions is that, do you see investing in gold in terms of investing in ETFs via a viable alternative than having the physical thing, or would you diversify for that?
I mean, I think it's okay to own the ETFs. I mean, the only risk is, I mean that they don't really have the gold that they say they have, but there's risk to having gold no matter where you have it. You know, I mean, we have a lot of gold in the Perth Mint. I think it's a safe place to keep it, with the guarantee from the government of Western Australia and reinsured through Lloyd's of London. I think it's pretty safe, but you know, nothing's foolproof. You take your chances no matter where you keep your gold. I mean, you can keep your gold in your house and somebody could steal it. You know, you can put it in the safe, you could get robbed. I mean, you could lose it. I mean, who knows? So, whenever you have an asset, there's always a risk that something happens to it, but you minimize the risk somewhat if you diversify and you have gold in various locations and,
And the last question is, as you know, Federal Reserve has taken away the M3 money supply calculation, the numbers that they report. Is there another way to reconstruct that?
Well, there are people that are doing it, and there are websites that do it. I think that the Shadow Government Statistics site does it. And I think that according to the people who keep track of it, you're talking about record growth. I mean, close to 20% per year growth in M3. And, you know, it's interesting. The government claims that they abolished the calculation in an attempt to save the taxpayers money for unneeded calculations. You know, of all the places that try to save us money, you know, the last thing the government tries to do. But it seems more obvious to me that the numbers were so big they just didn't want to report them anymore. And they knew that they were going to get bigger and bigger and bigger, which is exactly what is going on. But, you know, the government is in the create inflation game, which is their plan to create inflation, but they want to cover it up. I mean, they don't want people to understand the source of the inflation. I mean, that's why the government, you know, is constantly blaming OPEC for rising oil prices or China for rising food prices. They want to blame everybody but themselves. We're the only ones to blame. It's not Beijing or Riyadh. It's Washington, D.C. That's where the money is being created. I've said many times on this show that economic growth doesn't cause prices to rise, it causes prices to fall. Economic growth means more productivity, more supply, so lower price. What causes prices to rise on aggregate is the demand created by inflation. When you print more money, then people, you know, then prices got to go up.
But if I were to myself go to Google and trying to get raw data to get M3 to calculate M3 again,
I'm not really sure. I've never tried to do it myself. As I said, there are people that are doing it, but to try to construct it from scratch, I'm really not sure how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, maybe it's possible. Anyway, thank you for the call. I know I've got a few more on hold. Let me go to Bill from North Carolina. Go ahead, Bill.
Peter, thanks for taking my call. Great to have this opportunity to talk to you. My question is around short-term money that I have that I'm trying to protect, and I'm starting to run a little bit scared about this FDIC insurance. I'm not sure where they're going to get the money to pay off everybody, and they'd tie up all of our money, even if they could pay it off, if something went, something was catastrophic. What do you suggest for short-term money? Do you like holding foreign currencies, raw gold, and what do you suggest do?
Yeah, I mean, for short-term money, I mean, you know, we have money in the Merck Hard Currency Fund. People can hold shorter-term government securities, you know, like the equivalent of a T-bill, but in a Swiss franc or a Singapore dollar. You know, but yeah, you're right. I mean, the FDIC insurance is basically worthless. I mean, even if you accept for a minute that the government insures all the deposits, right, that they actually write it, they actually print enough money to make everybody whole in dollars, no matter how many institutions fail or no matter how big your account is. The problem is they give you your dollars, but they don't give you your purchasing power. And, you know, the fact that Americans are going to lose purchasing power is a sure thing. It's going to happen. I mean, there are trillions of dollars of losses are going to be imposed on Americans, whether they know it or not, whether it happens in real terms or because of inflation. It's going to happen, and there's no way around that fact. The government can't create purchasing power, no matter what it does. So it's promised so many things. It insures all the bank accounts and the brokerage accounts and everybody's pension, but it doesn't really insure anything. All it insures is that there's going to be inflation. And all it ensures is that people who put their confidence in the government are going to be disappointed.
Right. You know, I kind of owe you an apology. I made fun of people when they prepared for the millennium change by, you know, hoarding food and all, and then I read your book, and I buy into everything you say, and then when I get to the point where you say, you need to store gold in the Perth Mint because, you know, you're going to have to get out of here if something happens, and I'll tell you, this Bear Stearns thing was one step away from that happening. So I apologize for ever doubting anything that you wrote in your book. I loved your book. I've passed it out, and I really enjoyed it. So thanks for everything you're doing.
Thanks. Good. Thanks for the call, Bill.
Thank you.
Okay, and now I've got Earl from Pennsylvania. Go ahead, Earl.
Yes, Peter, I've got a question about my 401. You've got all my money that I can send you. My 401... I'm wondering about international funds that I have available.
Yeah, I've always encouraged people, to the extent that you cannot move your money from a 401k, you can't change jobs and roll it into an IRA, and you have to choose from the various alternatives that your plan allows, to always opt for international investments, whether it's, you know, foreign stocks, foreign bonds, or natural resource type funds, oil and gas, precious metals. Whatever you can do, but don't take the choices that are, you know, U.S. related.
Okay, so as long as I go international, I'm going to do better than staying here.
Domestic, yeah, I think so, without a doubt.
Okay. Well, I've got three to choose from. I can split them up or just go with one of them.
Do you know what their names are? Although sometimes the names are deceptive.
Well, I've looked at two of them. Euro-Pacific actually has 52% in Europe, 23% in Asia and the Pacific Basin, and 14% in Canada and Latin America.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds okay. At least it's 0% U.S. So, you know, you might end up with a lot of the multinationals that do some business here, so that could be, you know. But I think the key is you want to have your wealth abroad. Because people, you know, assets abroad are going to gain a lot of value relative to assets here in the States. And there's no way around that fact. So you're definitely going to be better off.
Is a 6%, what gets me, and I shouldn't be hung up on this, but a 6% front-end load.
Where are you paying a 6% front-end load?
It's what it looks like to me in their...
But are you sure you have to pay that as part of your 401k, or has that been waived for you?
Well, I'll get that clarified.
I would take a look at it. I mean, that would seem, I mean, a really, I mean, if I was an employer and I was going to set up a 401k for my employees and say, hey, these are the only place you can invest, I certainly wouldn't want to stick them with a 6% front-end sales load. I mean, that seems, but I think you would have paid that regardless of where the money is. I mean, you know, because you got to put it in some fund, but that seems ridiculously high for something that you're forced to do.
Yeah, I
look into it. I mean, and if I might complain to your boss, say, hey, well, why are you putting us with a 6% load? I mean, if you guys are making your own decisions and deciding that you want to invest money in a particular fund, I mean, what justifies the 6%, which is high anyway? I mean, 6% is huge.
Yeah.
It's for a mutual fund.
Well, one other thing, Zinifex.
Uh-huh.
They were bought out, weren't they?
No, they're merging. They're merging with Oxiana. I mean, maybe you can say Oxiana bought them, but they're buying them for stock. And so it wasn't anything that really made the share price bump up. I mean, I happen to own both the stocks, and I wasn't sure whether it was a good deal or a bad deal, for each, but I'm very bullish on both companies separately and combined. And, we continue to recommend. I mean, I don't think we were ever really recommending too much of Oxiana. It was a gold stock. But there were two other stocks that I was mainly buying in Australia, but, Zinifex has been a stock we've been buying a lot of, and up until the last few months, it had been a huge winner. The stock had just gone up. In fact, it was the very first stock that I recommended in my inaugural newsletter of the Global Investor, and it had done really, really well, and then it's more than 50% off its highs now. But again, I don't like to talk too much about the individual stocks on the show, but, you can talk to, call out, and speak to, one of the brokers privately about these stocks.
Okay. Well, thank you.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. And let me quickly take the second commercial break, and we will be back for more calls.
Euro Pacific Capital is an independent brokerage firm on a mission to inform its client base and prospective clients about economic and market events that could affect their financial security. Euro Pacific Capital seeks to provide solutions which are intended to provide safety, not risk. Solutions designed to protect our clients and their families from the U.S. government and its inflationary practices. The time to act is now, while you still have the opportunity to get your money out of the dollar. It's legal to do so, and after a consultation with one of Euro Pacific's brokers, you will understand how this decision could ensure your financial security. We offer a full array of services ranging from retirement and trust accounts to complete financial planning, checking accounts with or without debit cards, and life insurance, even annuities. With our independent, no-nonsense investment advice that's a cut above the run-of-the-mill commentary that has passed for research for far too long on Wall Street, we suspect investors will find a home at Euro Pacific Capital.
Okay, we are back, and more calls are on hold. I think we're up to, is it Ho in California?
It is Ho in Anaheim, and welcome to Southern California, Peter.
I know the weather is absolutely gorgeous. I come back here and I forget, what it was like when I lived here. I played golf all day yesterday, and no one's golfing in Connecticut at this time of year. It's barely back in the 30s.
My mom lives in Connecticut, and I grew up on the East Coast, and I love calling on Christmas and going. I'm sitting in the patio drinking Bloody Marys. Before I get to my question, I have to tell you, I've been watching your little video clips that you've been running from Fox News. And I got to give you kudos. I don't know how you managed to hold your calm when Wayne Rogers is melting down, and is it Mike Norman who goes nuts, and Pat who believes anything the government tells her. And I watch you, and I just think, this man is really showing class and being able to hold it together when these guys are just nuts. And I've noticed.
You might have lost it a couple times. If you watch enough of the clips, I mean, sometimes I get, but yeah, most of the time I do stay pretty cool. But yeah, I mean.
What I've really noticed more than anything, and I think it's important to note, is that the hosts of these shows, where they were really making fun of you early on, don't make fun of you so much, Peter. It's now a lot more you hear them say, okay, we've had our joke, but Peter was right.
They do, although not on CNBC, because the way CNBC deals with it, they just don't have me on anymore. So, but since I'm
easy way to deal with the problem, isn't it?
I'm still doing Fox and Bloomberg, but it's interesting. Everybody. There was an article in the Wall Street Journal today, and we called up because in the article they mentioned nobody could have possibly predicted what happened in mortgages, and of course we called my brother called him up who was working with the NPR, and he said, well, that's not true because Peter predicted it. I mean, he predicted it in interviews with you. He told you what was going to happen. And the reporter says, well, yeah, I know that, but, we don't really like to quote Peter because, I just think he was too full of himself or too sure of himself. So I don't want to give him, we don't want to quote him now.
The term for this is selective memory.
Yeah, I mean, they just like to pretend that nobody could see it. What do you mean I was, so it's a bad thing that I was so sure that I was right? I mean, I was right. The fact that I was sure that I was right should give me even more credibility. I wasn't, I wasn't, you know, wishy-washy on it. I wasn't hedging my bets. Well, maybe it's okay, maybe it's not. I was unequivocal in what I said and the disaster that we were creating for ourselves. And the fact that I was so sure and ultimately so right should be more of a reason why a publication like the Wall Street Journal would want to quote me in an article or you know. And I think with CNBC, they constantly talk about the fact that nobody could have predicted this, nobody could have predicted this, and therefore they have to selectively wipe my memory, of my appearances from everybody's mind. So that's one of the reasons that I think I'm not there, is because they don't want to have to deal with the fact that, wait a minute, there were people that were predicting it, yet they were laughed at when they did so.
And not only that, Peter, but if you were right, they were all wrong.
Yeah, and I think the other thing is, people don't want to have to admit that I might still be right about new things that I'm saying. Because if I was right about all the other things that I was saying, then maybe I'm right about the things I'm still saying. And people don't want to acknowledge that things are as bad as I say they are.
Well, I was putting away gold and silver long before I found you. And the reason I joined up with you guys is because the more I listened to you, more I kept saying, this is a man who's singing my language, and I understand what he's saying, and he's got to be right, because it's exactly how I see things, and I couldn't be more pleased.
All right, well, great. Well, I'm glad that you found us, and now that we're working together.
Can we just say a big hi to Danny?
Okay.
Absolutely love her. Okay, here's the question. You mentioned the big drop in gold. What you didn't mention was the big drop in silver.
Oh, I did. It dropped from $21 down to below $17. And, you know, same thing. It's had a $4 drop, which, you know, as I said, I mentioned at the top of the show, wasn't too long ago when silver was $4. That was the whole price. And now it's dropped by that in a week.
Right. But here's what happened. When it dropped, people tried to buy silver, and there wasn't any. Canada's out. The U.S. Mint is out. The Persian Mint is out. The Australian.
But no, they're not out of silver. I mean, maybe some dealers are slow to deliver it because they don't have it in inventory. But there's silver there. But I agree that there's not a lot of silver around, and that's why prices are going higher. You know, there's a lot more demand for silver than supply of silver.
Why? And a lot of articles have come out and said there's no silver anywhere. The big dealers.
I don't believe that those articles. I mean, there is silver out there, and I don't think, you know, I think a lot, I don't know what's behind a lot of the. The articles that claim otherwise, but there is silver there. But yeah, I mean, there's, you know, I think there's a lot more demand right now than supply, which means prices for silver are going to go higher, and
they should.
Why we buy it? I own a bunch of it myself, and I think it's going to go up.
Now the inference here would be that there's been a lot more paper silver sold than there's physical.
Well, yes, but I don't necessarily know that that's the case. I mean, people are trying to pretend that those that are like the Perth Mint, where they're saying we're storing your silver, that they're actually don't have the silver that they claim to be storing, and I disagree. I think the silver is in fact there, and there is certainly enough. I mean, we're not talking about huge amounts of silver. You know, as far as there's plenty of silver to accommodate. The certificates that exist in something like Perth.
I've never heard that said about the Perth Mint, not the Perth Mint at all. I have heard it suggested about SLV, though, and I have heard it suggested.
There you'd have to believe, again, for that not to be true, you'd have to be talking about the auditors and outright fraud, because these funds are audited, and there's independent auditors that are going to report on the ounces of silver in that they own, and it needs to, that they sign off on the fact that there's silver behind the shares. But yeah, as I said, it's always possible that there could be fraud there, although I've seen no evidence to suggest that there is. Anything is possible, right? I mean, look at Enron was audited, and obviously the auditors were wrong. Now, this would be a lot more straightforward, right? Go in there and count the bars of silver and see how much they add up to and compare that with the number of shares outstanding. That should be very simple to do. It's not as easy as looking through the books of an Enron to try to figure out, you know, what they're worth. So I think it's certainly a lot simpler to keep track of how many bars of silver SLV has in deposit. And so it's not that difficult a job for the auditors to get it right.
Okay.
All right.
Fair enough. You've answered my questions.
All right. Well, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
I've got two more calls on hold, so let's not take – if you're not on hold now, don't call because I won't have the time to get to you. Let me go to Kevin in California. Go ahead, Kevin.
Oh, hi, Peter. I have two quick questions. The first one is if you could briefly explain Euro-Pacific Capital's strategy in exploiting the expansion of the Chinese markets, say, for instance, in Hong Kong. And the second one is, if if we're pretty sure, because I remember at the conference just recently in Newport Beach, you said that the RMB is likely to appreciate 4-1 versus the U.S. dollar in its favor. If that's the case, is it usually, do you think it's a better strategy to be relying on the high dividend payers in Canada, the energy trusts and so forth, or do you think that if you're taking a very long-term approach and you're young, that you should be more heavily investing in China, where you'll...
Well, look, we have a balanced position. We have money in both markets. And remember, if we do get the kind of demand out of China that I think, there's going to be a lot of resources sent to the Chinese, and, you know, Canada is going to be a major supplier of resources to Asia. But, yeah, I mean, we have exposure to the growth in the Chinese market through a lot of the companies that we own in Hong Kong and Singapore, where the lion's share of their revenues are being derived in the Chinese mainland, and their customers are Chinese consumers. And so as the Chinese currency increases, as Chinese citizens attain a greater level of purchasing power and thus are enabled to enjoy higher standards of living, we're going to benefit from owning businesses that profit from that. But the main reason that I don't necessarily load the boat with the Chinese exposure is because we don't know for sure when the government will give up these pegs or how much longer they will try to keep their currencies low. And when they, by doing this, they are debasing their currency and inflicting problems. So we don't want to have too much exposure to pegged currencies, even though I think ultimately those pegged currencies could provide the greatest amount of profit because we're getting in at an artificially depressed level. If they keep those pegs for much longer than we would hope, then ultimately we could be in trouble with the peg currencies as well because we end up owning get a lot of inflation. So I want to strike a balance. I want to make sure I have some of the currencies that aren't pegged at all and that are being allowed to rise, like the euro or, you know, like, you know, and have exposure there. And some of the other currencies, like in the natural resource currencies where they have, you know, those currencies have been rising and they have solid interest rates. But I am looking for more ways to get more exposure even to mainland China and interesting investments, and, you know, and as we discover them, we will bring them to our clients.
And the second very quick question deals with, you know, I'm about 25% of my portfolio now invested with Euro-Pacific Capital. I'm trying to get more and more out of the dollar. But one thing I'm concerned about with investing with Euro-Pacific Capital is the fact that I've been purchasing a lot of very high-paying dividend shares through the Canadian Oil Trust and so forth, and the dividends are great, but one thing I'm concerned about is the fact that there might be a change in the way energy is produced. And I just was wondering your thoughts about being too heavily invested, perhaps maybe in oil or natural gas.
Well, as I said, I don't know that. I'm not sure about how there are going to be any changes in the way it's produced or what that might mean. But, you know, we own some of the stocks in Canada that are not in oil and gas or other trusts. And, you know, we have, you know, we do try to keep oil and gas investments as a reasonable percentage of our portfolios. It might be 15% or 20%. So, you know, we don't overweight a particular portfolio. If your particular portfolio for some reason is highly concentrated in one sector or one country, then you might look to take, when you add to your account, you might want to ignore those sectors and try to build up some exposure to other regions and other sectors so that you're not too heavily weighted in one in case there is something that happens that is unforeseen but that somehow undermines the value of the oil and gas that are being held in reserve by these companies. But anyway, thanks for the call. I've got time for one last call, and I don't want to leave him out. So we've got Al hanging on the line from New Jersey. Go ahead, Al.
I got some Icelandic bonds through you.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been running across some articles on the net, you know, that there are some problems with the, you know, banking system in Iceland now, that they're raising rates because the...
Yeah, the rates were just hiked recently. I think there's something like 14 or 15%.
Yeah, 15%.
Yeah.
I was just wondering, is there any, you know, risk?
Obviously, if you're buying a bond, you know, you're buying an Icelandic government bond, you're not necessarily, you know, in a bank deposit, so if there are some problems there, it's only to the extent that the problems result in more inflation in Iceland if they print more money. But it seems to me that if they're willing to put their interest rates up to 15%, that the bank is somewhat committed to defending the value of their currency. and not to allow it to get out of hand. But yeah, I mean, look, when you get a small country like Iceland and you're getting a yield like 15%, you got to keep it in perspective. You know, you can't put all of your money into Icelandic debt. But, you know, given the fact that the yield is so high, you know, you can certainly, you know, put a portion of your money in there. And, you know, and even if, you know, you get a 15% return for a couple of years, and then there's some problems, as long as it's not, you know, a catastrophe, you're still probably ahead of the game.
Yeah.
But just keep it in perspective. It's a small country, and, you know, you want to put some money in Iceland, you know, I wouldn't, you know, talk you out of it. But again, you know, I wouldn't have, you know, my entire account in Iceland.
Oh, yeah, definitely. It's a portion. The other question I wanted to ask you was about, you know, your buy and hold strategy. Is there any possibility that you might consider, like, an actively managed Euro-Pacific fund, or like?
Well, we are considering it. We're going to be doing it. I mean, I'm just, you know, it's something that has been on the back. You know, I've been trying to get it done actually for quite some time, and I just am so busy, and I keep having other people doing it for me, and it takes so long. But we still are in the process of coming out with some actively managed themed accounts, which are going to be more not to buy and hold, collect dividends, because I still think that the best deal for the client is to not pay a management fee and to not have a managed account when we're buying to collect dividends. But we are going to have themed managed accounts where trading is warranted, where we're not simply buying to collect dividends, but where we are in fact trading, looking to buy and sell, and so we're going to have managed accounts where people will be able to put money on deposit with my registered investment advisor, and we will in fact manage the portfolio based on various themes or criteria. So people will be able to pick, oh, I'd like to have money in this particular managed account program, I'd like to have money in that one, or you know what, I want to be in all five of them, and manage it as you see fit. So we will be adding these features to the company, and as soon as it's available, I'll be talking about it on the show, and you know we'll have emails about it. So you know, we'll get it done before the year's over. But I've been trying to do it for a couple of years, and it just hasn't gotten off the ground.
Yeah, will that be like individually managed accounts? Or?
Yes, it will be individually, separately managed accounts, and I also will likely be working on hedge funds, which will be different too, where the you know the minimums will be quite a bit higher and the criteria for being a member. But the individually managed accounts, I think, will be a, you know, people will be able to get in with a smaller amount of money. But it still might be limited to accredited investors. I'm not sure, and I don't know exactly what the minimums are going to be. But you know, I mean, they'll probably be at least 100,000, if not more. So it won't be for small accounts, but they will be. It will be.
I have over a million with you, and but what I would. Like hoping was that you would have like your own fund, like you know.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to operate like that, you know. But I still think if you're, you know, for the basic, you know, dividend collecting in foreign stocks, the best thing to do is to buy and hold and minimize the transaction costs. And so you don't need a lot of active management other than helping you reinvest the dividends if you don't need them. But you know, there are certain types of, you know, areas of the market and regions of the world where I think active management can really add value. And so in those cases, we're going to offer managed alternatives.
Yeah. No, but I'm not referring to individual accounts.
Well, I don't know if I'm likely to launch a mutual fund anytime soon, you know, if that's what you're thinking about. I might. I mean, I've thought about it before, and it was always the costs and the regulations that kept me from doing it. But I don't know. I mean, never say never. I mean, the firm is getting bigger and bigger and bigger.
Yeah, that's why I'm asking, because the firm is bigger, and also the volatility in the markets is getting much higher. And, you know, somebody who's stuck in a buy-and-hold situation could take a big hit, especially if the account is several years old.
Well, I don't know. People aren't going to take a big hit if they're buy and hold. They don't have to sell. Then you collect dividends. So, you know, only if there's an unfortunate situation where the buy and hold investor, comes into circumstances that forces him to sell prematurely, and the market happens to be, you know, in a bad condition when you're forced to sell.
Yeah.
But anyway, thanks for the call. I'm running out of time, and feel free to call again in a later program. Anyway, that's it. It's been a quick hour, And I want to get back outside where there's still some California sunshine left. But anyway, thanks, everybody, for being here. I will be back here again next week from Connecticut live to do Wall Street Unspun. Make sure, if your friends want to hear it, the rebroadcast on my website at www.europac.net. Call toll-free to talk to a Euro-Pacific broker, 800-727-7922. 800-727-7922. And if you haven't read my book, Crash Proof, How to Profit from the Coming Economic Collapse, make sure and pick up a copy online or at your bookstore. If you've read it, tell your friends about it. And if you haven't written a review on Amazon, go up and write a review and tell everybody else what you thought of the book. Thanks, everybody. I'll be here again next week. So long.